evening, ladies and gentlemen. I have your attention. Welcome, bienvenue. Je m'appelle Anne Broom. I'm Anne Broom. I'm chair of the Friends of the Library. C'est avec grand plaisir que je vous accueille ce soir à notre premier événement de la saison pour les amis de Bibliothèque McGill. We are very excited to have as our first event this evening an evening with Wendy Owens, who is the curator of our visual arts committee here at McGill. We are about to have a wonderful illustrated lecture with a fascinating title, Landscapes, Light Bulbs, and Bears. And as you can see, it's not the type, it's the bears of our beautiful sculpture on campus. So who knew that McGill had an art collection? And those of you who've studied here did know, but we are about to discover the absolute jewels around the campus. Many of you have come to our events before, but perhaps some of you have not, so you may not be familiar with the Friends of the Library, which is a group of volunteers and advocates and friends of McGill Libraries whose role it has been to raise interest and act as advocates and supporters of this wonderful jewel that is McGill's libraries. And it's been a very exciting year, this past year, for the libraries and will continue to be so. The library has just completed a feasibility study that has looked at ways to reimagine the library on campus and will be rolling out a master plan, which will be made public to the public in the month of October. Exact date to be divulged, I think, by the end of our meeting this evening. I'll be able to tell you at the end. But it's an exciting time, and the Friends were very pleased to be able to support this feasibility study with a donation of $70,000 last year to show our belief in this in tremendous project looking ahead. So it is an exciting time for libraries around the world and particularly for McGill going forward. Without further ado, I would like to introduce our speaker for this evening, Gwendolyn Owens, who is, I think within the last 2 years, the first curator of the visual arts collection here at McGill. And she is responsible for the very wide-ranging collection of art at McGill. We have more than 2,000 works of art, both within our buildings and outdoors on the campus, across our two campuses, downtown and at McDonald campus. She has previously held curatorial positions at the University Museums of Cornell University, Williams College, and the University of Maryland, as well as at the Canadian Center for Architecture. Her scholarly publications include articles, exhibition catalogs, and books on a wide range of topics, from 19th century American landscape painters to kitchen wallpaper to Montreal artist and architect Melvin Charney. The book Nature, Modern Nature, Georgia O'Keeffe and Lake George, for which she contributed one of the three essays, recently received honorable mention from the Association of Art Museum Curators. She is also currently finishing a book on the artist-architect Gordon Matta Clark, beginning work on an essay for the book accompanying the McMichael Collection's forthcoming exhibition, Seeing Beyond the Visible, Lauren Harris and Transcendental Painting, 1925 to 1950. Ladies and gentlemen, I introduce Wendy Owens.
I have to check and see if the mic is all set. Are we good? Okay. So I hope I won't crash it to the floor. Anyway, thank you, Anne, for the wonderful introduction. And I am thrilled to be able to be here and talk to all of you about the visual arts collection. I'm also thrilled that there are some people who have been important to the visual arts collection in the last couple of years who are here. And as I talk, I will probably mention some of them. So I'm going to start off with that old philosophical question. If a tree falls in the forest and no one is there to hear it, does it make a noise? So I've got a corollary. If a university has an art collection and no one knows about it, does it exist? Plenty of people said to me, I told them that I was going to manage McGill's art collection. McGill has an art collection? Really? Where is it? The fact is that the collection, or most of it, is in plain sight. If the discussion with my inquiring person goes further, usually my questioner recalls that yes, he or she has seen works in the collection, but they're so much a part of the campus environment that they're sometimes forgotten. Some people also need to be reminded that sculpture is art, portraiture is art, and yes, maybe they did see a few paintings on campus. My job now is to manage that collection and make more people aware of it, to let people know that we have landscapes like this work by Homer Watson, contemporary art like Jean-François Quintin's installation in the Wong Building, or the famous Friendship Fountain, aka The Three Bears by Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney. In fact, we have over 2,000 works of art spread over the two campuses. We don't have one art museum at McGill, we have many, as our collection makes up a museum without walls in 60 buildings plus the grounds. A collection like the one we have at McGill takes some special care, and it's actually more challenging than in a sort of usual art museum. When you're the curator in a traditional art museum, as I have been, you can control the atmosphere, the security, and basically everything that happens to the art in your charge. Not so to a collection spread over two campuses. The collection, as you'll see tonight, is really varied. This is James Square that I think most of you are familiar with. But we also have, tapestries. This is in the Arts Building. This is the famous mural by Marion Dale Scott called Endocrinology, with it's in Strathcona. This is stained glass that was in Hosmer House. It's now in McDonald Harrington. And we do have paintings. This is one of our paintings. And when I say portraits, this is actually a portrait, but it's a portrait of a cow. We also have prints, and this is Sarah and Masai, who worked last summer to catalog a collection of Japanese prints, which we received. And we also have wall murals, and this is Danse de la Paix by Robert Roussy. And here is a work called On by Marie-France Bruyère. And when McGill builds a building, 1% of the cost is spent on art. And this is one of the works that was bought through that program. The collection is largely Canadian, but not exclusively Canadian. There are other collections at McGill with works of art, as some of you may know, in archives and also in rare books. But the difference is those collections do not circulate. They're preserved in one location to be used there. The VAC, by definition, is across the campus. So the art collection here at McGill, not surprisingly, dates back to the 1830s and the beginning of the university with, of course, portraits of James McGill. And here's a view of the opening of the Redpath Library in 1893, the reading room that's now Redpath Hall, where many events and concerts take place. You'll see a large painting on the wall at the left, and I'm going to point because if I try to move, I'll send this thing to the floor. That's a portrait of Principal William Dawson. And there is that same portrait today in the Arts Council room. Again, we're back in Redpath Hall. This is about 1930, and there are now paintings along the wall there. And it's a little hard to see, but there's a sculpture of a voyageur. I think it was probably in plaster. But I just want to make the point about how it was part of the atmosphere at McGill all the way along to have works of art on the campus, and especially in the library. So when the new Redpath Library opened in the 1950s, a competition was held to select an artist to paint a new mural for the space. So this is how it looked in the 50s when Roy Heenan, then a McGill undergraduate, was studying in the reading room. And as many of you know, he went on to become a lawyer and collector, and his collection was on view in the offices of his firm, Heenan Blakey, all across Canada. Roy told me that art became a tonic for the law And it was studying in this reading room that inspired him. So McGill now has two terrific Jean McEwans in the law library that Rohinen gave to the collection, sort of giving back for a next generation. And in talking to students, which we like to do a lot, they love studying where their works of art are around. So in the past, I've worked with a number of university collections directly and have been asked to evaluate the management of even more. So I say this is not my first rodeo. But in most cases at a university, the collection is expected to have its own support, its own endowment to survive. And it doesn't matter if the university is very rich, like Harvard. Harvard expects their art collection to support itself, or not so rich. University collections are expected to be self-sustaining entities. We'll talk about that more later. Here's the three bears. And until my appointment, the collection was always managed on a part-time or a volunteer basis. Pam Coombs took on the role of curatorial assistant in the 1990s, but her appointment was and is only one day a week. But everyone did their best to care for the collection. These are the groundsmen who lovingly build this structure to protect the sculpture every fall. And that's been done, I think, right since the 1930s. And here it is in the winter, safely in its box. It always looks to me a little bit like it's a rocket that's going to take off. In 2012, a group of loyal members of the McGill Community for Lifelong Learning did some investigating and registered their concern. After some hesitation, the university listened. In 2013, I was asked to work out a new collections management policy for the Visual Arts Collection, which is essentially the rule book for how to manage a collection and oversee a survey of the collection to see if everything was still where it was supposed to be on the two campuses. And you can guess what the answer to that is. So in working with the collection, sort of worked out, it's really four collections. It's the outdoor sculpture collection. It's what I call the heritage collection. These are high value, sort of priceless works that we have that are really unique. We have the historical portrait collection, and we still commission portraits, so this is a growing collection. And then we have what I call the campus enhancement collection. These are works of lower value that can be put in more general areas. We try to treat every work of art as important. This is not saying that the things in the campus enhancement collection aren't important, but I would just worked it out in terms of being aware of these different collections that we have. But a funny thing happened on the way to writing a policy and planning a survey to find where everything was. People came out of the woodwork with questions, comments, and ideas about the collections. My thought was at one point that someone must have secretly done a press release without telling me, but it was just word of mouth. There were donors who were interested in giving to the collection, research inquiries, people who wanted reproductions of works in the collection for books, other institutions who wanted our advice on managing their collections because, of course, McGill is seen as a leading institution, so we must have the answer. Rosalind Goodman, the champion of the Goodman Cancer Center, had the idea of doing an exhibition to promote both the Goodman Cancer Center and the Visual Arts Collection. Clearly, there was a lot to do, and lots of people were interested. So for the survey of the collection, I sent out a job description hoping to hire four energetic students to survey the collection over the summer. Almost overnight, I had 100 applications to wade through, and most of them were from students who were smart, very smart, had studied art history, and many had museum experience already. I hired a great team, including an art conservator who'd gone back to school, and we began. Using existing location records, the team went out two by two to verify the location and the condition of every work in the collection. They would take a photo, complete a form about the condition, add labels to the back that said, do not move this work, call visual arts, and move on. They worked like fiends, nonstop, getting through this collection. They learned to ask about what art inside closets, in tour the basement and the attic. You're going to see a lot of ladders. We had found that you know, people had forgotten about works of art, and we have one story where someone said, no, there's no need to come, there's no art here at all. And we got there, and you know, right next to the filing cabinet is a giant painting. And it's just, oh, I guess it is. It's art. I'm being discreet. I'm not mentioning either the painting or the department. This is the attic at the Galt Estate, which was actually up where we went on that adventure with the ladder. And right there, you can sort of see something that is looks like sort of a funny sculpture with a hole in the middle. That's by the French artist Pierre Bonnard. And it was a gift to the collection specifically to be shown at the Galt Estate. And we found it in the attic. It's now down proudly on view because we've explained to them, and now they understand. They just didn't have the information. Here we are with another ladder. So this is at Davis House, and this is the solarium, and the only way to get there right now is through a ladder. And this is what we found inside, this wonderful, wonderful mosaic. So what did we learn from the survey? In addition to documenting current locations, we learned how much art means to people in their environment. Most people love the art in the office. Some, however, who had the art selected for them by someone else, and when they found out they could change the art, they were on the phone to me at 9 a.m. the next day, excited that they had the option of having art that they liked in their line of vision. And of course, we have zillions of stories about people telling us what they hated, what they liked. And in the case of the art found in basements and closets, no one was trying to do anything wrong. The art had just usually been taken down for very good reasons, to keep it safe during a renovation or because there was a leak, and yes, sometimes because someone didn't like it. But the intention was not to harm the art, even the art that didn't find favor with the occupants of an office. There was simply no information about what to do. Art had also migrated. Someone who liked a painting moved it when they changed offices. Or the chair liked what was in the conference room, so he moved it to his office. And sometimes what we discovered that this had happened two or three times, so we could trace the migration of a work of art through several buildings. More ladders. A survey is something you have to do every 2 years at a minimum, and this summer a new team did another survey. Valerie Moscato and Emily Baker, too, filled out forms, climbed ladders, that's a particularly big one, and actually performed minor surgery. This is Valerie, who had to remove ivy from the back of a watercolor, and I'm happy to report that both the ivy and the work of art are just fine. And along the way, my team made friends. Most people, even the ones who'd forgotten what was near the photocopier or the filing cabinet, were thrilled to learn more about the collection. After two surveys, I think it's safe to say that most members of the McGill community whom we met became champions of the works of art and are now our eyes in those 60 buildings. They call us if something is not right. And I have to say also there are urban legends with every collection, and our particular urban legend is that professors take paintings home from their offices when they retire, stealing it from McGill. Okay, it may have happened once or twice, but the evidence is more likely that somebody took it down and put it in the closet, and it got forgotten. So those works that have gotten lost are really largely misplaced, and we find them. A few professors have actually asked me about buying art from their office when they leave at retirement, and this is not in accordance with our collections policy. We also found friends in facilities and university services. Working with them, we're securing works in public locations, and before any renovation happens, we remove the works of art from the spaces affected. And here we are vacuuming a tapestry before it's removed from Strathcona Music. Notice, it took a lot of us to sort of, you know, handle this before we did it. And yet another ladder. We removed more than 100 works from Old Chancellor Day Hall before the renovation of that building that's still ongoing. And every work that we move is wrapped, sorted, and in this case, we were sorting it in three categories: works that were fine, works that needed minor treatment, and works that needed a lot of care. And this way, we have easy access to things when we go to do anything like get things reframed, reinstall them, whatever. And some cases we have sculptures, so we have to deal with that in a different way, and put it in, carefully putting it in boxes. We also participated in the heritage survey of McGill buildings. Done over the last two summers, the survey of the buildings had as a purpose to create a fiche on every older building so that the university had information on the heritage value or lack of value for each structure. Our role was to be involved when a building had art integrated into the building. We added information about any art that was something that was not a movable element: relief sculpture, murals, or stained glass. The heritage survey revealed some surprises. In Beattie Hall on Pine Avenue, which you see here, we were alerted to a series of 7 murals in offices on the top floor of the building. This is what we found. They likely date from the mid-1920s, when this floor was added by the architects Robert and Francis Findlay for Edward Beattie, president of CP Rail and chancellor of McGill, who purchased the house. The 4 rooms where we found the murals were originally one large space that was later divided into offices for the Department of Nursing and then Communication Disorders. We still don't know who painted the murals, despite the fact we've done extensive research and have been in touch with our colleagues, really our colleagues all across Canada. Who do you think this is by? But everyone agreed that they should be saved. So here is an art conservator examining the works, and they have now been removed. They're being treated, and we will conserve them and hope to find an interesting place to put them. Excuse me. This is an initiative we have called Art in Classrooms. We're now working in tandem with other units on campus. And this is our first Art in Classrooms installation, which is a collaborative project with Teaching and Learning Services. The works here are by the artist Anne McCall. They definitely brighten up the basement classroom in Leacock, where this is. And you'll notice something unusual. To the right, there's a label. So as we do more installations, we hope to put up more labels that identify the works of art. It's a particular problem. I see someone nodding. We don't have labels on the works of art. And a label may sound like a simple thing to create, but a good label for an art object is sort of like a haiku or a sonnet. It's short, informative, and well-written. Then we translate it into French and try to make it just as good. We also want to have labels that won't come off the wall, and the label shouldn't be a souvenir. We want it to stay there. Here's another initiative. This one we call Curated Spaces. These are public spaces. In the Bronfman Building of the Des Hôtels Faculty of Management, we did installations on the 4th and the 5th floor at the request of the Dean's Office. Work in both installations came from the recent gift of Dr. Joanne Jepson, a McGill graduate in medicine who spent a lifetime collecting art, largely from the Far East and from North American First Nations communities. And this is a particularly terrific addition for us in that we have very little First Nations material at all. And I have to add a little aside. Dr. Jepson came to visit us and was just so thrilled that the art is out there that she went right home and said, I have more for you. So we're very happy. And this is a sculpture by Peter Monk, who is a donor to management, a graduate of management. And he and his wife, Joan, successfully built the company Paris Gloves, but he was quietly being a sculptor and taking classes, getting to be better and better, and eventually has become a professional artist whose work has been shown in exhibitions and purchased by collectors. But perhaps the most amazing experience for all of us as a group was the exhibition of highlights from the collection in the Bellini Atrium last June 9th. It was a bittersweet event, as the person behind the event was Rosalind Goodman, who died the summer before. 2 months before she died, Roz had called me and said, I don't want to do another gala let's year. I want to do an exhibition for the McGill Visual Arts Collection to support the Goodman Center. And my answer was, let's do it. We began planning it together, and then she died. No one wanted to give up on her idea, however, and last June, we had the exhibition. For my team, it was a fabulous opportunity. So here is Cynthia Bergeron and Valerie Moscato and Daisy Charles going through the ideas of what to put in the exhibition. And any exhibition project goes through multiple phases and plans, and this one, despite the fact that it was small, was no exception. It wasn't always going to be in Bellini. We were planning for other spaces on campus, so we went through probably 6 or 7 different versions, all of which is completely normal in my experience with exhibitions. And also, because the Visual Arts Collection does not do temporary exhibitions on a regular basis, borrowing works from across the campus, we had to develop new forms, new procedures, all for this event. We did a brochure about the Visual Arts Collection designed by Valerie, and I've got copies of it here. We divided up the task of writing labels, and then Cynthia ably translated them into French. By the time of the exhibition, Emily Baker had joined our team, and Lexi Stefanos, who was an area intern for Professor Mary Hunter and an expert on Marion Scott, joined us as well. Note the latter. The paintings looked fabulous, and the biggest complaint I heard that night was that so many people came to the event that it was hard to see the paintings. Some people who were there can speak to this. And I was actually thrilled that one of the people speaking at the event was Debbie Goodman Davis, who is Roz's daughter. Debbie's an art consultant in New York. She also happens to be a former intern from the program I ran at Cornell. So it is possible to make good in this field. Sure, or people can, you can pass them around. That's great. So what are we doing now? The portraits in Redpath Hall that need conservation are going off to the conservators tomorrow, thanks to a generous donation. We continue to be involved in caring for art before and after renovations when we reinstall the works. We're going to the Mac campus for a reinstall next week. Most offices know that they can change up the art on their walls, and they do now. We do the installations and take back works every week. So and they go out into another office. Sometimes something comes back and it's off again in a month. So at any given time, I'd say that we have about 1/8 of the collection in storage with us, but it's not the same 1/8 from month to month. And one of the things we always know when people have changed jobs here, because what seems like the first call now is to us, which is sort of fun. I'm also thrilled that an artist and collector has already stepped up and made a commitment to leave a bequest to support students and care for art at the VAC. And I also see artist John Schweitzer, who's also been a great supporter, too. And gifts of bequests that come to us, I wish everyone a long and pleasant life. And by the time these works come, I'll be running the National Gallery, the Museum of Modern Art in New York. But the collection will be better taken care of. It's a terrific start for all of us. And this collection needs to be a resource that does not compete for our limited provincial funding. The collection is also continuing to grow, as it should, and I believe that it needs to grow within its means. In other words, we can't accept more art than we can catalog each year. Everything we accept must be revenue neutral. In other words, it can't be art that requires immediate or ongoing conservation care. We have a section of our storage, which I call the hospital section, of works that are waiting for treatment. And I don't want to add to that group. I'm going to try to anticipate a question that comes up every time I speak. Why don't you just sell some paintings so that you can take care of other ones? So this is called deaccessioning, and it's among the most controversial and complicated issues for museum professionals. Ethical rules in my profession dictate that if you sell the art in your collection, the money should go to buying more art or perhaps caring for the collection, but never to say pay the light bill, or if you run a university collection, upgrade the athletic facilities. This is why you have a collections management policy, so you have a guide. We run something that's basically a public trust, and we are beholden to people to follow the rules. Foundations look at this, the government looks at this, so we're careful. When you break these rules, you do it at your own peril. And you can see, I've highlighted what happened at Brandeis. One can deaccession, and I've actually done so at other institutions. Once when we had two paintings that were by the same artist, not a pair, but very similar, and once when the institution had duplicate images of a group of photographs. In each case, we did really careful documentation and confirmed that the choices we were making would not weaken the collection, and then we used the funding to buy more works for the collection. We also made sure we were in touch with the donors, that even though donations to collections are almost always unrestricted gifts, it's a very good idea to make sure that your donor understands what you're doing. Again, at your peril if you don't do this. Too many institutions try to do this secretly, and it always backfires. Many museums also have sold a work of art for far less than it's worth now, or they discover that this is the key historic work in an artist's career, and their collection is then missing something crucial. A collector has gotten in touch with me about giving McGill a very important collection of Inuit sculpture, and he and I have talked about the collections management policy and deaccessioning extensively because he's read enough to know the rules and said he's not interested in going further with the discussion unless I can confirm that we have a working collections management policy with a deaccessioning clause that makes it clear. And deaccessioning efforts that break the rules or seem to break the rules tend to provoke lawsuits, as you can see. And I have no desire to be a part of any effort that would embroil McGill in a legal situation that would be costly financially or in terms of public relations. And the public relations side of deaccessioning is huge and hugely important. I can breathe. That's off my chest. I've answered that question. So I wanted to say that we've got a website now, and we can return to happier subjects and talk about this. And I hope you'll look at it, and then you can learn more about the collection. We don't have a database of everything we own that's yet online, but we hope to have one someday. We're about to be put up on a website about the City of Montreal is doing about public art in Montreal. And this summer, we became part of the library here. And my office is now centrally located in McLennan, and our storage is climate controlled. I want to show you one of our latest installations. This is a Jack Bush painting and a John McEwen painting that we've installed on the main floor of the McLennan Library. So just as Roy Heenan found art to be a tonic when he was a student, I want today's McGill students, no matter what they're studying, to come to like art and to get to know it by having the experience of seeing it firsthand for free as often as they would like. Finally, if you remember one thing from this talk, I want you to remember the terrific effort of the students and young professionals who've worked with the collection and how we are a teaching collection. It's amazing to me that up to my appointment, the university had not taken advantage of the collection's potential for being a laboratory for those interested in careers in art-related fields or those who just aspire to collect. I've worked with institutions at many institutions, and with absolute certainty, I can say that the McGill students are more motivated and smarter than anywhere else where I've worked. I give them responsibility and authority, and they always rise to the occasion. Sometimes they have no choice because emergencies tend to wait until I'm out of town. Other people have recognized the capacity of these amazing people. Of note is the fact that Josh Mantanko, who worked with us, is now getting a PhD at Yale. Cynthia Bergeron is at Stanford. And Cheryl Thompson is teaching at the University of Toronto. Daisy Charles, who recently graduated, is now my capable assistant, and she will go back to school next year. Also here tonight is Valerie Moscato, who will be entering an art conservation program, and Emily Baker, who will graduate from McGill this fall and go on to a graduate degree. And I want to ask, Daisy, Emily, and Valerie are all here today. I want to ask them to stand because they deserve high praise, and I'd like you to recognize them. So thank you for coming. I hope you'll look at our website. There are brochures. And now you know that when a tree falls in the forest, maybe it does make a noise, and McGill has an art collection. Sure.
So Wendy has said she'll take a few questions. Does anybody in the audience have
Wendy, McGill and the McCord Museum have a very nebulous relationship.
Yes.
McCord is what? Thousands of pieces of art.
Yes.
What access, if any, does McGill have to the McCord collection?
So, by definition, anyone at McGill can have access to the McCord collection, by definition. In reality, it's sometimes a little harder. So, to explain, the McCord is its area is history, and we think about our collection in art. So, as you say, there are works of art that you can pick up historically or in terms of art. So it is a collection that we cooperate with. One of the things that does happen, too, is someone calls me and is looking for something, and it turns out they're better served by going to the McCord. So I would say it's a cooperative relationship.
Yeah. Want to stop and discuss that, and we don't know what's really going to happen to it. I do know that the ceiling was there at one point, and whenever he was laid out with TV, he drew on all the walls. And I know this from the librarian of the part of the medical library up there at the big soul.
Well, and it's interesting because the Royal Vic and the hospitals are actually a separate entity from us. So again, a collection we cooperate with. The feasibility study that's about to happen, I mean, I'm delighted to know about this. So this is the kind of thing that I would love to know if there are any traces. Okay. Yeah, something else that I would like to have to to have more traces of is when McGill had a studio art program. And we are looking to collect in that area and document art by the artists who were in that program. Arthur Lismer and John Lyman both taught at McGill. And one of the things that I'd like to say is I'm sort of Lismer's successor, because this famous member of the Group of Seven is said in 1946, we better make a list of the art. So I'm doing what he said.
I have to remind you that the people who first graduated with one of them is here, Nancy Petrie, and my husband, they got their BFAs from the first program. So by 1952, they graduated. And of that group, we had them all up to T. 22 of the 25 were still practicing artists 25 years after graduating.
That's amazing. Yeah. That really speaks to a really interesting program.
Any questions? Yes, Matt?
I wondered if you had seen the stained glass windows from Weston Pool at the music building, new music building.
Yes.
There.
Yes, they are in storage. They're carefully put in custom boxes. So this is one of the challenges at a university, is when renovations happen, taking things down and putting them until you find another place for them. But the Weston Pool stained glass windows are carefully in boxes.
One more question?
Cesar?
Oh,
one more question. How big is the collection now? And what role does the education of students play in your overall mandate?
Okay. The first thing about how big the collection is, we have in our database a little more than 2,000 works of art, but the collection was cataloged retrospectively, which means that it was done in the 70s and 80s, and they didn't catalog everything that was out there. So we have a system. We use the number 50 because nothing was accessioned in the year 1950. So when we find something that isn't cataloged, we give it we give it a 50 number. The phrase is, did you 50 it? So we probably have another 150, 200 works that are out there that are technically the visual arts collection. Very often these are things that are they're Maurice Cullen murals that are in Davis House, which we would want to accession. And in terms of my mandate and the educational aspect, you can see that my sort of perspective on this is to take this part of it very seriously. Since the Art History Department has been aware of the collection and the use of the collection, more and more students are coming to me asking about writing papers on the collection, which is a great way to build up information on the collection. I actually taught a course on museums last spring, and there's a student who's going to actually shadow me for a couple of days, which is tricky. I said, you're going to look at me playing on my computer a lot. So I think it's huge in terms of what this collection can and should be. And I think that one of the myths is, well, don't major in art history, you'll never get a job. And of course, I majored in art history and I got a job. But the other thing about education about art is you don't have to become an art historian. I think it's something that can be, many people can learn about art history and go on in life like Roy Heenan and become a lawyer or something else.
I think this gentleman here had a question. We don't
have a question. Excuse me. Great revelation, Wendy. Thank you for the very engaging lecture. My question is, was there any resolution of the Brandeis Museum deaccessioning policy?
Okay. Yes. So just to give you a little background, Brandeis University, after the downturn in 2009, and actually Bernie Madoff had a serious problem because they had invested heavily with Madoff. So they had a serious crisis in terms of money. So they announced they were going to get rid of their whole collection, just one fell swoop, and they didn't tell the museum director. And they said, we're not breaking the collections management policy because it's no longer valid because we're getting rid of the whole collection. It did horrible things to the reputation of Brandeis. It cost them a huge amount of money in lawsuits because it was called the Rose Art Museum, and the roses got into the picture and figured out that they couldn't do this. So in the end, nothing was deaccessioned. The collection is still there. Brandeis as an institution is still there. They lost a great director because when something happens like that, directors of the gallery always have to fall on their swords and leave, which I think was very sad. So yeah, it's scary stuff to deaccession collections, and as I said, I've actually done it, but it's like elective surgery. You have to be really sure it's not going to kill the patient.
Well, I have to say how much I've enjoyed getting a taste of the collection that McGill has, and I'm curious about your most wonderful discovery, your best day, the day that you will always remember as the very best in this job. And if you don't mind telling us the worst, like the disappointment that you had, or if you'd like to share that with us.
Wow, because there have been a lot of highs, not as many lows. What's the best day? The best day may have been the event in Bellini, where we had this collection on view. I was incredibly proud of all that we were able to accomplish. One of the things, we were putting art into a room. We had to get special hooks made for that wall. And we just, I mean, everything had to go like clockwork because we had 300 people coming for an event. And then I know it was rough for people who were there to actually see the art, but we got to see the art earlier because we were there earlier. I think that has to be the best day because that was truly a revelation. Worst days. You know, worst days are, you know, when something that you can't control goes wrong and you have to sort of stand back and deal with it. Anytime a work of art is harmed, it's sort of, you know, it's sort of like it hits you in the gut. We've had a couple of cases where something has happened to a work of art, and it just, all of us feel it physically when that happens. So that, the days when something like that happens are the worst days kinds of things. The other thing about art conservators is they can work magic. It's basically like you call the doctor and say, please make it better, and they do. But so that would be, those are the two extremes that I can think of.
And in terms of discoveries, in terms of a piece of art that was discovered through your work?
So the sequence, the ladder and the attic at the Galt Estate, finding that Bonnard piece was really, really exciting. It was a gift of Regina Slatkin, who's was a 1929 graduate of McGill. She loved McGill. She was an art dealer. She was a serious art historian. And yeah, that was really exciting to find that. What you don't see in that sequence is that you don't have sound effects, because the first person up the ladder, who was actually Daisy Charles, who's here, when you go up that up into that attic, there's a drop. So Daisy went up and then stepped forward and screamed. And I was a little worried. But anyway, that's my finding something. But I mean, even when we find something that is not a Bonnard, we are always so happy when we repatriate something or find something that has been misplaced.
I think that's an awfully high note of which fan. I'd like to ask David Lank, who's been a very long-time friend of the library and a member of the Visual Arts Committee, to give a formal thank you.
Thank you. How many of us have heard that expression, I know nothing but art, but I know what I like? Sorry. that's not good enough. There are canons of good taste that go beyond personal preference. I started off 40 years ago, and I'm going to give a little context that Wendy may not be totally aware of. We had a committee that was struck 40 years ago to look at the collection at McGill. And there was going to be a representative from each of the faculties, and I, as the, at that time, the chair of the McCord Museum, the outsider. Our first meeting was in June, where we decided on the agenda for the meeting in September, which reviewed it so that when our meeting in June took place, we would then be able to discuss the following September. And 3 years later, not a thing had happened. And this is not anecdotal. This happened to me. I got a handwritten letter from an unnamed, very senior person at McGill saying, David, lay off. McGill can't afford culture. We've come a long way. A very long way. Take me to your leader. The swan said, take me to your leader. And Wendy said, take me to our ladder. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you.
Endowed Shakespeare Lecture, which will take place at Pollock Hall. We have the renowned Shakespearean actors Ben Carlson and
Deborah Hay,
thank you, Stephen, who are a wonderful acting couple and a couple in real life who will be here to entrance you. They are going to be interviewed on stage by Paul Yakin, who is a McGill Shakespearean scholar and also happens to know this couple very well in life, so I think their exchange on stage should be absolutely wonderful. So please join us on November the 9th. It will be at 5:30 in Pollock Hall. We look forward to seeing you then. Thank you for coming. Thank you.
Thank you. You're Nancy?
Yes.
Yes, we spoke on the phone.